Tina Martini and Rich Linkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab. So hit them up with any questions you have.
Welcome in, Legal Face Off on WGN Radio, WGNRadio.com. The Legal Eagles are here, back in the saddle. Rich Linkoff and Tina Martini. My name is Sam Padianovich, and Ben Anderson is behind the glass. We have a new nominee for the Supreme Court. We'll talk to another candidate for mayor here in Chicago. We have Trump reversing Obama's affirmative action policy, and we'll talk about a new book about the Constitution, plus the legal grab bag at the end of the show. But we start with two guests in studio, Michael Scodro, partner at Mayor Brown, and Ashley Keller, a partner at Keller Lenkner LLC, to discuss Brett Kavanaugh, who has been nominated by President Trump. Welcome, both of you. Thanks for joining us here in studio.
Thanks very much for having me.
Thanks for having me as well.
All right, let's jump right into an issue that's already generated lots of discussion, a woman's right to privacy. I think that it's probably clear by now that Judge Kavanaugh won't address that issue directly at his confirmation hearings because, you know, I think that's the trend. But what in his prior writings, prior speakings, can we glean from how a Justice Kavanaugh might deal with a woman's right to privacy? Michael first.
Sure, thank you. Well, I do think it's difficult. I think the court watchers are doing what they can with his existing jurisprudence. There was a recent decision that has been getting a fair bit of play right now involving a young woman and her ability. She was being detained by immigration authorities and her ability to obtain an abortion and Judge Kavanaugh's vote against granting her that relief. I think it's difficult to read a whole lot into one decision. Obviously, that is a data point. But, you know, when you go up on the court and you're dealing from a slightly different perspective, and I think we're going to have to wait and see. I completely agree with you that it's going to be – we'll get almost nothing, I suspect, at the hearing.
Ashley, your thoughts. Is Roe, is Casey in jeopardy, or do you think we'll hear from Judge Kavanaugh that – it's well-established precedent that he won't address and that he does honor precedent, as we've heard from not just many prior nominees, but many supporters of Kavanaugh?
I think you're right that you're not going to get very much from the confirmation hearing on that. That's a function of our long broken confirmation process, which is perhaps a separate question. But sure, he's going to say at the confirmation hearing what every potential justice says, which is that he respects precedent. But that's not going to answer the critical question, which is when is he willing to discard precedent and overrule a previous ruling from the Supreme Court? And unfortunately, I think it's true for liberals and conservatives alike, you cannot get the answer to that question based on a judge's Court of Appeals record, because as judges on the Court of Appeals, they are in fact bound by Supreme Court precedent and the doctrine of stare decisis. And it is only once they are elevated to the ranks of a Supreme Court justice that you can deduce how they treat precedent and when they're willing to toss it aside. So, unfortunately, regardless of which way you come out on the abortion question, we're just going to have to wait and see when it comes to eventual Justice Kavanaugh.
Yeah.
So, gentlemen, much has been made over Judge Kavanaugh's feelings on executive power. In a 2009 Minnesota Law Review article, he wrote, "I believe it is vital that the president be able to focus on never-ending tasks with as few distractions as possible." Ashley, should this disqualify him from confirmation, and should he recuse himself if he's confirmed? Do you want to kick that one off first?
No, it should not disqualify him from confirmation. If you go on to read the rest of that article, what Judge Kavanaugh recommends as a policy matter as a result of his view expressed from the quote that you mentioned is that Congress pass a law to exempt the president from these distractions so that he can oversee the office of president of the United States. So he's expressing a policy view there, and Congress is, of course, free to accept or disregard it. They obviously have not accepted it with respect to this president. And I don't think that it harbors any indication of how he's eventually going to rule when it comes to questions of executive power as a constitutional matter. And beyond that, even if it did, the fact that he has a view on executive power, which is perfectly in keeping with the view that lots of folks have with respect to the separation of powers, is hardly something that I think disqualifies him to be a Supreme Court justice.
Michael, agree with that?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think This is undoubtedly going to be a showcase of the hearings. You're going to see quite a bit of discussion of these. This article, there was another article on the same lines. I think that that will be front and center. But it is not unusual for, you know, judges to have voiced views on issues in an abstract sense. I think in terms of recusal, you tend to see that much more in cases where there has been direct involvement with the litigation itself, with the controversy.
Michael and Ashley, you both served as law clerks for the Supreme Court. Ashley for Justice Kennedy, who Brett Kavanaugh is seeking to replace. Michael for Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. If confirmed, Judge Kavanaugh, would join a seemingly strong block of five conservative justices. What are your thoughts on that, Michael? Do you think that he is likely to continue as a Supreme Court justice the way he's ruled in the past? And what are your thoughts on the idea of Justice Roberts perhaps now becoming a swing vote?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. You do hear a lot of people speaking about the potential for the Chief Justice to become the swing vote. I think that's based largely on a sense of a kind of very loose sense of a political continuum at the court, with the notion that the chief would lie at the center of that continuum. I think what's interesting about, you know, there's a saying that whenever you appoint a new justice, you have an entirely new court. And I think that that has proven true. It will undoubtedly prove true with this next appointment. But I think in terms of the swing justice, my own sense is that you're going to see a group of potential swing justices, is my sense. It may not be as consistent. There may be particular issues where the Chief Justice is indeed a swing in the sense that his vote is more gettable by either side. But I'm not sure that's going to be true across all issues. If you think back historically, Justice Scalia was, in a sense, a swing vote on certain Sixth Amendment questions, where he was leading the charge on what you would call pro-defendant issues in the criminal context. So there was that kind of perceived crossover. And so I suspect we may see the definition of who is a swing may be slightly broader under this new court.
Master, what are your thoughts? You clerked for the man that was perceived as the swing vote for the last generation or so. What are your thoughts on Kavanaugh joining this conservative bloc and whether we'll see another swing vote the way we've seen them in the past?
So I think this is a situation where the conventional wisdom is largely correct. I think the Chief Justice is going to be the new quote-unquote swing. I think that's a little bit of a misnomer in terms of the depiction of it. It's more that the Chief Justice is going to be ideologically in the center of the court. And I think it's also fair for people to say that a Supreme Court where Chief Justice Roberts is the center is a more conservative court than the one that involved my old boss, Justice Kennedy, being the perceived center of the court. I don't disagree with the previous proposition that there are going to be some specific issues where you can't just predict the result based on political alignment. An originalist and textualist approach to the Constitution, which I suspect will be the approach that Justice Kavanaugh brings to the job, oftentimes involves results where, quote unquote, the liberal position prevails. Criminal defense, plaintiff side matters, punitive damages, things of that nature, where I think you could see a potentially surprising outcome from a political vantage point. But when it comes to the methods of Justice Kavanaugh's jurisprudence, I expect him to be more conventionally conservative from a jurisprudential vantage point.
So, Ashley, let's kick off this last question here with starting with you. As Rich mentioned, you clerked for Justice Kennedy, as did Judge Kavanaugh and Justice Gorsuch. Even though clerks only work for a justice for a year, do you think that working for a justice molds you into the attorney that you become? In other words, can we look to Justice Kennedy's legacy on the court as a preview to what kind of justice Judge Kavanaugh would be?
I certainly think that clerking for a Supreme Court justice, A, it's a tremendous honor, and B, it's a year that's formative in your development as an attorney. But like most clerks, I came to the job already having clerked for a court of appeals judge and going through law school and having varied life experiences. And all of that is a significant part of the mix as well. And so while, of course, Judge and potentially eventually Justice Kavanaugh is going to have much of his experience having been shaped by having clerked for Justice Kennedy. I wouldn't say that that's sort of the single most formative feature that he's going to bring to the job. There are lots of other things in his life background and his subsequent experience that I think are going to inform the type of justice he's going to be.
Michael, what are your thoughts? Did you go into your clerkship thinking one way and then came out a Justice O'Connor disciple?
I agree with Ashley. You bring experience with you. Of course, you are quite young at that point, and it is an incredibly formative year. You're exposed to issues that have, for the most part, divided the lower courts. These are challenging jurisprudentially, doctrinally. There's no doubt that there are aspects of Justice O'Connor and her approach that sort of picked up along the way. But it's also its approaches to the law more broadly, or to the professional life more broadly. I mean, her commitment to public service, for example, from a young age, that was something that she instilled in her clerks. And I ended up spending many years working in government, and I think in no small part based on those conversations with her.
Well, we'll end off with a question that we love to ask of people who have been in your position, clerking for the Supreme Court, one of the, upper echelon jobs you could ever get as a lawyer. Surprisingly, they weren't recruiting at Northern Illinois University College of Law when I was there. But we love to ask people who have done that, give us the inside scoop. Tell us something, for example, about Justice Sandra Day O'Connor that our listeners would be surprised at. Michael, what do you? Any insights you could give us?
Wow. All right.
Tell us something we don't know. In other words,
Ashley,
you've got a few seconds to think about that one. I put Michael on the spot for this one.
Well, it is. It may be somewhat known, but maybe not the extent. Justice O'Connor was, and I think remains, an incredible fitness advocate, and to the point where she had, this has been reported, this is not totally news, but a lot of people seem to express surprise when they hear it. She had a morning exercise class, an aerobics class in the courthouse that folks could attend. And she was also a consistent tennis player, golfer, and quite the fly fisher, as I understand.
Were you involved? Wow. Did you have to beat her to the gym every morning? So she invites the clerks?
She invited. It was it was a group of women that she had met that lived near the courthouse on the hill, and at their request, as I understood it, it was always limited to female members of the court staff. And so my co-clerks did in fact go every morning. And a number of folks from around the building went every morning.
Ashley, surprise us with a Justice Kennedy quick story.
Sure. So Justice Kennedy loved the Supreme Court, which is no surprise, but maybe more of a surprise, is that love was repaid by his colleagues by putting him in charge of the cafeteria and maintaining the grounds of the court. And so he used to go out walking the cafeteria and the grounds of the court, which is, of course, open to the general public. And would often be caught taking pictures of visitors to the court who didn't realize that he was Justice Kennedy. And so, they would get their pictures taken in front of the John Marshall statue by the justice.
Wow.
And they would have no idea that the person who snaps this photograph was Justice Kennedy himself. So he was a really gracious person who enjoyed walking the building that he loved so much.
That's amazing. Amazing insight. Well, thank you both very much. We'd love to have you back on the show as this story and other Supreme Court stories develop. Ashley Keller from Keller Lechner LLC, kellerlechner.com. Mike Scodro from Mayor Brown, mayorbrown.com. Thanks for joining us on Legal Faceoff on WGN.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The following information is considered advertising material. You're listening to Rich Lenkoff on Legal Faceoff. Rich is a partner at Bryce Downey & Lenkoff and handles workers' compensation, general liability, and entertainment law. He's been selected to the 2017 Illinois Super Lawyer List and has been named leading lawyer from 2012 through 2017. Rich has been honored as one of the 50 most influential people in workers' compensation by SEEK Incorporated and is a frequent lecturer for many national organizations. Rich also is the legal analyst for The Bill and Wendy Show and Pretty Late with Patty Vasquez on WGN. Bryce Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service law firm in Illinois and Indiana. Among their other practice areas are business litigation, construction, employment law, insurance coverage, intellectual property, and professional liability. To contact Rich and to learn more about Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, visit bdlfirm.com/WGN.
We go out to the phones and tag in Gary McCarthy, former Chicago police superintendent, now running for mayor in Chicago, taking on Rahm Emanuel. The website, garyformayor.com, G-A-R-R-Y. Mr. McCarthy, welcome to Legal Faceoff.
Thanks for having me.
Gary, given your experience in law enforcement, including serving as Chicago Police Department superintendent from 2011 until 2015, public safety is obviously one of your big priorities. Where has Rahm Emanuel failed in this area? And tell us what you do in the first 50 days of a McCarthy administration to reduce crime.
Well, the politics has ruled the day in the police department here. It's a political organization. It needs to be a performance-based organization. And this was evident subsequent to my termination. City Hall came into the department, rewrote policies, conducting a witch hunt, because minor disciplinary cases that were in the pipeline while I was superintendent resulted in people being forced to resign after I was terminated. And that was all because the mayor thought that it was politically astute for him to be tough on the police, not recognizing the fact that in 2016, less than half of 1% of the shootings in the city were police-related. And by the way, it doesn't mean that all of them were bad shootings. Some of them were very much justified. So let me put that another way. In 2016, had nobody been shot by a police officer in the city of Chicago, 4,300 people still got shot. So the police aren't the problem in this city. The criminals are. And if a police officer violates the law, they need to be prosecuted like any other American citizen or any other person in our society. Let's put it that way. And if they violate policy, they need to be disciplined or retrained. But you don't just wipe out a generation in a department and expect it to be performing at the same level that it was.
So what steps would you take, Gary, to reduce crime as part of your administration?
Well, the same steps that we took when I was the superintendent. We created probably the most comprehensive gang violence reduction strategy in the country, which has to do with intelligence. We recorded every gang in the city, every gang turf that they believed that they owned. I always say that because I'm not willing to grant them any turf. That belongs to the people of Chicago, and all the membership and all the disputes. Because what happens is somebody gets shot in one neighborhood, and all the police go to that shooting. Well, that's not the right thing to do, because you need to know if that person who got shot is a gang member, what gang they're a member of, and what gang they're in conflict with. And you deploy your resources to where the other gang is, and we were picking up guns and stopping the retaliation shootings. And that was done based on data and proactive police work. But with it, we were also doing a number of non-enforcement strategies that the mayor has cut funding on. For instance, we were taking gang members who were on parole, working with parole, bringing them into meetings, and having conversations with them and giving them an opportunity to get out of the life through social services, jobs, getting identification cards so that they could move forward. And this was a program that we were running in, I think it was about 9 districts in the city, that's now been cut to 4. And that was done because money's going to other places. Money is not going to social services. Here's the bottom line, what's happening in the city. We're losing our tax base because we're losing population. We've been losing population for the last 10 years, the only major urban center in the country, I believe, that's lost population over the last 10 years. Who are we losing? We're losing middle-class African-Americans from the South and the West Side. Why are we losing them? We're losing them because of gun violence. Because we're losing them, we're losing our tax base. And because we're losing our tax base, we're pulling social services and closing schools. Where? On the South and the West Side, which is causing more gun violence. We've thrown ourselves into a huge cycle here that needs to be addressed in a different fashion, more holistic fashion. There's something called collective efficacy, where we can actually, government, we can't fix society's problems. We can't create parenting. But what we can do is create the conditions where that can actually happen. It's called collective efficacy. It's something that we've been doing for a very long time that we're not doing here in Chicago.
Gary,
development in the neighborhoods where we need to have development. We need to bring back trade schools, and we need to give small businesses tax breaks to go to those neighborhoods to create the market for young men and women with those trades to come out and have jobs. That's not happening.
Gary, picking up on that point, you will inevitably have to answer Emanuel's claims that he has done a lot for economic development, especially in luring corporate headquarters back to the city. Certainly if Amazon decides to relocate their headquarters and brings 50,000 jobs to Chicago before the election, that'll be, I think, an asset that Mayor Emanuel can leverage in his campaign. How do you answer that? And also, what other steps would you take to create economic conditions, not just in neighborhoods like Streeterville and Lincoln Park, but in some of the neighborhoods that you mentioned on the south and west sides?
See, that's exactly what I'm talking about. The economic development that's happened in the city is exclusively downtown. There's cranes in the air downtown. That's great. And there's unions who are giving him money as a result of the fact that there's cranes in the air downtown. The south and the west side and the other neighborhoods are drying up. And exactly what I just said. We need to bring back trade schools because we need carpenters, electricians, auto mechanics, and so on and so forth. And then we can take and put those folks to work in those neighborhoods where we have these deserts of abandoned housing, redevelop those for affordable housing for individuals, and give the small businesses tax breaks to go to those neighborhoods, not just give the Amazons tax breaks to come here. And just think about the fact that if Amazon does come here, who are they going to hire? It's not going to be people who live downtown because they're not going to be able to afford to do that. They're going to be hiring people from the suburbs. They're not going to bring job development to the people who need it the most on the south and the west side.
So, Gary, last question. You were born in New York, and you spent your adult life there and in Newark until you moved to Chicago back in 2011 when you were hired. Do you think that voters will elect someone like you who's a relative newcomer to the city, especially given that in this mayoral race there are so many contenders this year, many of whom have deep ties to the city?
Well, so I can tell you this. First of all, my answer that I love to give to that one is show me the 78th neighborhood in Chicago called Winnetka. It doesn't exist. And I challenge anybody from Chicago to look at my Bronx neighborhood and tell me what it reminds you of, because it reminds me of Chicago. So that's first of all. Second of all, I'm not leaving this place. And where I was born, I don't think makes a difference, except for the fact that the answer doesn't fly to me, well, that's the way we've always done it here. If you always do what you always did, you always get what you always got. And right now, what we've got is failure. 7 years of failure in this city, it's got to get turned around. There has to be a different method to address it. There has to be business management of City Hall, which is not happening. We've got to stop doing everything politically. If anybody ran their business the way that Rahm Emanuel runs City Hall, they'd be out of business in a heartbeat. It's really evident, and it's failing.
Gary, have you dropped the Yankees or the Mets in favor of one of our Chicago teams? That's what our listeners really want to know.
Yeah, well, you know what? The short answer to that is when I got here, I told Jerry Reinsdorf that I was going to root for the White Sox because I'm an American League guy growing up in the Bronx. And he said, Gary, I'll take you for 155 games a year as long as we're not playing the Yankees. But I met Joe Maddon, and this guy has won me over in a heartbeat. What a wonderful man. If he's in a room with 200 people, he makes everybody there feel like they're the most important person in the room. So I root for our Chicago teams all the time. I can't give up on my Yankees and Giants, though. At the end of the day, I'm still watching what they're doing, but I'm rooting for Chicago.
Well, maybe we'll see a Yankees-Cubs World Series. That's Gary McCarthy.
I was dying for that last year. That would have been so great.
Gary McCarthy, he's running for mayor of Chicago. The website is garyformayor.com. Gary, thanks for joining us on WGN, and please come back when we have a mayoral debate. We'd love to have you back on Legal Face-Off.
Thanks, Gary.
Absolutely, I will be. And all our policies are going up on that website so we can expand on these things we discussed. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
You can follow Legal Face Off on Twitter. You can like us on Facebook. And you can always find the show on iTunes. Search for Legal Face Off. You can always rate and review the show. Joining us now on the phones, Anurima Bhargava, who is the founder and president of Anthem of Us. She joins us to discuss President Trump reversing former President Obama's affirmative action policy. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, Anurima, you back during Barack Obama's administration headed up civil rights enforcement in schools for the Justice Department, and you helped to write Obama's administration's guidance. Last week, the Trump administration said it was rescinding Obama's administration policies, which provided guidance regarding affirmative action, which called on universities to consider race as a factor in making admissions decisions. Can you fill us in on this decision?
Sure. So in 2011, we issued two sets of guidances, one for higher education institutions and the other for K-12 schools. And the goal was to provide a tool and resource for those schools to use when they wanted to promote diversity and address segregation in schools. And the Trump administration has decided that it no longer wants to encourage and support efforts around the country to do that, to really sort of try and address the divides and segregation that we're seeing. And so it rescinded those guidances last Tuesday.
So how relevant is that to the goals of affirmative action in this country? In other words, are these merely directives? Explain to our listeners, you know, the difference between guidelines, how much enforcement is behind these directives, guidelines, whatever term you're going to use.
Sure. So the Supreme Court has had a lot of cases that have come up in the last 15 years around what's the proper use of race and the consideration of race in admissions. And so the question of how you can promote diversity has been something that came up from the University of Michigan, and then it came up again in just the last couple of years from the University of Texas. So the law hasn't changed since those decisions, and those decisions say pretty clearly that there's a bunch of different ways in which schools can promote diversity in a way that is consistent with the Constitution and federal laws. So the rescission of these guidelines, the guidelines are really just trying to help out, right? And so the rescission of the guidelines is more important in my mind as a signal to the country that this administration isn't behind those kinds of goals, isn't behind what it is that the Supreme Court has already said we can do. Instead, they want to send a message that these kinds of efforts to make sure that our schools are ones that are open for people of all different backgrounds, that's not something that they are actually going to be behind. And that's what I think the import of the decision last week is. But again, the law has not changed here.
So why is this happening now? I have a hard time believing that it's a coincidence. We've got Justice Kennedy who's stepping down. We are knee deep, I think, in the brief filings for the Harvard litigation, which, you know, we would love to get your comments on. Why? What do you think in terms of the timing of this decision?
I think the timing of the decision has most to do with the Harvard case. And that's a case where there's a group of students, Asian American students, who are challenging the ways in which Harvard is taking account of race and trying to promote diversity in its admissions process. And there's some deadlines in the Harvard case at the end of the month. And my sense is that the Justice Department wants to take a different position than the guidances laid out. And I don't know what that position would be, but that they rescinded the guidances so that they can take that position and not be inconsistent with what it is that the Supreme Court and the law and, frankly, all of these guidances have said over the last 15 years.
We've just covered the pending confirmation battle that Judge Kavanaugh, he's not a justice yet, of course, will face here in the U.S. Senate with a couple of former Supreme Court clerks. How do you think this issue will play out, not just in the coming term, but in the inevitably seems to be a right-leaning court with a solid five-justice block, seemingly opposed to some of these directives?
Sure. So this is another one of those situations in which Justice Kennedy has been the one who has written a number of the decisions that have allowed schools and colleges and universities to promote diversity and address segregation. And so in some ways, having a new justice on the court put some of these decisions in question. And unfortunately, it's one of those moments where it would be, again, a situation in which if there was some kind of different way in which the court went, it would be contra to what it is that the court has said repeatedly in the last couple of years. So this is something that has gone up, that's been settled. And now, once again, we have a situation in which the concern is that without Justice Kennedy, there may be a turn, and that turn would fall on, the difference between, in one justice and go against what has been sort of longstanding precedent by the court. So I think this is another one of those issues that's going to be hotly debated. And part of it is part of a longer narrative around the country right now, which is that there's been so many efforts to separate and divide. And this is part of a campaign of division. It is incredibly important that at a time where our schools are incredibly segregated, where we see that students are going to schools across the board, regardless of their racial background, regardless of where they live in the country, in schools that are often as segregated as they were in 1970, and we see increasing division and hate, that schools are a place where communities come together and students get to learn and play together. And I think that part, that notion, this idea that we're going to have America that is more united rather than divided, is something that comes up in the Supreme Court fight as well.
Yeah, and we see, examples of what you're saying as recently as this week. We're about to cover in our legal grab bag segment the incident with the woman who was wearing the Puerto Rican shirt. These issues aren't going away. In many people's eyes, are getting worse.
Yes, and it's incredibly important for us to talk about how we want our schools, what we want our schools to be a place where we raise another generation that really doesn't know each other, understand each other, and respect each other, and understand how important it is for us to be able to live and work together, particularly in the global community and society and workplace that they're often going to be in. And those are all fundamental questions that are at stake when you have administrations that are going counter to the law, counter to the U.S. Constitution, counter to what communities around the country want, which is to actually have their kids be able to go to school together. And they're saying something quite different, which is we want to continue to try to separate and divide.
Anna Rima Bhargava, founder and president at Anthem of Us, former Obama administration Department of Justice official. Thank you for joining us on Legal Face-Off on
WGN. Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
Our final guest on Legal Face-Off, he is an author, Joseph Tartakovsky, and his new book, The Lives of the Constitution, 10 Exceptional Minds That Shaped America's Supreme Law. Joseph, welcome to Legal Face-Off.
Joseph, thank you so much for joining us today. You have a really interesting background. You're the former Deputy Solicitor General of Nevada, and you are also the James Wilson Fellow in Constitutional Law at the Claremont Institute for the Study of Statesmanship and Political Philosophy. You've written a book, The Lives of the Constitution, and we'd love to hear a little bit more about what the story is you're trying to tell with the book and what it's about.
Well, thanks so much for having me. I'm trying to tell the story of the American people's adventure under the Constitution. We're in our third century under this document, and no other people on earth have lived under a written constitution longer. And the purpose of the book was to figure out how we pulled it off as a nation. And I did that by examining the lives of 10 people from the beginning of our history to the present, different eras, different backgrounds, and see how they overcame the various challenges of their time and see what lessons it has for us today.
It's fascinating because you choose of the 10, some people who are very well known, like Alexander Hamilton, Woodrow Wilson, and others that are lesser known, like Stephen Field, Robert Jackson. Tell our listeners how you chose your subjects, and also maybe things about them that we thought we knew that we don't that your book highlights?
Yeah, well, I wanted to tell unknown stories or to introduce Americans to people that deserve more attention. So I picked some famous people, some less famous people. With the more famous people, sometimes I've taken a different spin than is common. And above all, to make it interesting. We have 10 people, so with take a Hamilton, for instance. Hamilton was almost unique among the founders. This is one of the aspects I discussed in trying to build up faith in the government. That was sort of his preoccupation. He was different than almost every other founder in that respect. They sort of had this instinct of sharing government. You can divide up all American history, really, into the Hamiltonian and Jeffersonian tendencies. Hamilton wanted to read the Constitution as a document of energy and breadth, flexibility. Jefferson, of constriction. I try to make the point that Hamilton lost many of these fights in his day, but we've come to accept his vision. And just as one measure of that, for example, you could take a State of the Union speech and you'll have a president get up, whether it's a Barack Obama or a Trump, talk about the sweep of our foreign trade, how robust our military is, how carefully they're controlling the economy in Washington, D.C. These were Hamilton's obsessions, and these were things that terrified Jefferson or that he thought were unconstitutional.
So what are some, so you're telling this story in your book as a story, and obviously I'm sure that there's some themes, general themes that emerged over time with different things that have happened during the course of history. Do you want to comment on or share some of those general themes that have emerged?
Yeah, sure. I think that one of the things that I find is true of our history is that we have this great constitutional text, but without question, that is not enough. You can't just have the right words. You have to have a culture or a spirit of constitutionalism that is just as important as the text itself. I mean, if you took our Constitution and superimposed it on a Turkmenistan or something, how long do you think it would last? So this spirit is it's not just a form of government that we have. It's a character, and you see this in all sorts of ways. I mean, this commitment to property rights, to fair play in elections, to human equality. These are things that we often fail, we depart from, but in the long haul, it's sustained us. And it's interesting how these same themes crop up in very different places and with very different people.
Joseph, the title of your book is The Lives of the Constitution. We're about to embark in yet another confirmation process of a Supreme Court justice. We just had a couple of former Supreme Court clerks on the show discussing Brett Kavanaugh. Inevitably, one of the issues that always comes up when discussing these openings is whether the Constitution is a living, breathing document, or whether the founders intended the document to be strictly interpreted based on what the framers meant when they wrote it. What are your thoughts on that, given the title of your book, The Lies of the Constitution?
I find generally that the talk of living constitutionalism or strict construction, they're sort of slogans, and they're not all that helpful. If you want to talk about the founders, it depends who you ask. I mean, Thomas Jefferson began using the term strict construction of the Constitution when George Washington asked him whether Congress could create a bank. And he asked for a memo from Jefferson. He asked for one from Hamilton. Jefferson said, no, the Constitution's to be strictly construed and doesn't mention a bank. Hamilton said that there were implied powers, that it should be read with more creativity and looseness and flexibility. So the fight between the competing interpretations began, you know, we're talking a few months into the Constitution's operation. I think when you take it issue by issue, it's more illuminating. But if the question is whether the power resides in judges, that's where I'm sort of in agreement with Scalia, who's one of the figures in my book, that the Constitution unquestionably has been adapted in different generations to apply to the peculiar circumstances of their time. That's not a statement of constitutional theory. That's just a fact about how our life has been lived under the Constitution. The Commerce Clause operated differently in a time when people lived in self-contained little villages and they had everything they needed within a mile of their home and in a world of interstate and international commerce. That's just the reality. The Constitution has to be adapted, and sometimes it's done through new interpretations, and sometimes it's done through constitutional amendments. But I think what people get caught up on is the extent to which courts ought to be doing this, and that was a kind of the great jurisprudential fight between Scalia and, say, Brennan. And I think when we use the term living constitutionalism, I think that's where it ought to apply to.
So, Joseph, last question. We're clearly at an interesting inflection point. We're about a year and a half into the Trump administration. There's obviously a lot of interesting things going on politically and otherwise. With respect to constitutional jurisprudence and the research that you did to write your book, if history has any influence on the future and to the extent it repeats itself, based on, you know, your experience and your research, what do you think we have in store, you know, in the short to medium term?
That's a rather broad and open-ended question.
You can tailor it however you like and make it as narrow an answer as you'd like.
But I'm confident because I believe that this country has deep reserves. This is a politically tense time, although there haven't been that many periods in our history free of such tension. But the founders had doubts about whether their Republican experiment, as they like to call it, would carry on. The difference between us and them is we have 200 years of history in the middle in which we've overcome tense political times, civil wars, foreign wars, invasions, presidential assassinations, every imaginable form of constitutional crisis, and we seem to pull through it. And pulled through it really pretty well. We have 56 unbroken presidential elections in this country. So we have a lot to be proud of, and we have essentially a history that is an encyclopedia of lessons in the art of preserving free government, and we should draw on them. That's part of what my book attempts to do, but we should remember that we've been through these difficult phases before, and the most important thing is sticking to our principles and ensuring that we pass on this inestimable inheritance that is our Constitution, and more than that, our constitutional culture.
The book is The Lives of the Constitution, 10 Exceptional Minds That Shaped America's Supreme Law. Fascinating read. JosephTartakovsky.com. It's available online and in bookstores. Thanks for joining us on Legal Faceoff on WGN.
Thanks so much for having me.
First story is the breaking news involving the Puerto Rican shirt incident. Local story that got national and international attention, actually, to the extent that the leader of Puerto Rico has weighed in on it. Luis Gutierrez was on the floor of the House yesterday talking about it. This is a story involving a man named Timothy Tribus, who we've now all seen the infamous video of him ranting against the young lady who was wearing a T-shirt with the Puerto Rican flag. He is ranting in a very racist way against her, saying, "You're not a citizen, you know, you shouldn't be in this country," etc. He's obviously inebriated in the video. And, you know, perhaps equally or even more disturbing is the lack of action by the police officer on the video. There's a Cook County Forest Preserve officer seen in the background of the video, and she is asking him to intercede. She feels threatened, and this officer does nothing. Well, over the last couple of days, we've now seen that the state's attorney has filed 2 class 3 felony hate crime charges against Tribus. Those carry sentences between 2 and 5 years. They've been elevated from an assault and disorderly conduct to these hate crime charges. quite appropriately, in my opinion. Also, the officer has resigned, and then they turn that into a termination. So all around, pretty disturbing actions here by these two individuals. Thankfully, the authorities have acted quickly, but I'm sure you've seen the video. It's been seen by millions and millions of people, Tina.
Yeah.
What were your thoughts when you saw it?
Incredibly disturbing, but it just seems to be more of the same of the environment we're in right now. A lot of hatred, a lot of ignorance, and all around the whole incident, just from the fact that it was the Puerto Rican flag and saying you can't wear it here, and just the way that it was handled, it was terrible.
Well, the thing is, people have, you know, in the video, Mia Irizarry, who's the young lady who took the video, who's the victim, she talks about the fact that Puerto Rico is, in fact, a U.S. territory.
It is.
And you know, but who cares, right? I mean, that's a good point, but does it matter? I mean, what if this was a Ivory Coast t-shirt
or Cuba,
a Brazil t-shirt, right, wherever? I mean, this guy is just ranting and raving, and I think it's a product, as you mentioned, of, you know, where we are as a society with a lot of these issues. But I'm glad they charged him with a hate crime so quickly. Next story is involving the Emmett Till murder investigation. After 63 years, the feds have reopened this probe. What's going on with that, Tina?
So back in March, the Justice Department told Congress that it had reopened this probe. For our listeners who are not familiar with this case, Emmett Till was a 14-year-old black youth who was shot and beaten back in 1955 after allegations by a white shopkeeper that he had made sexual advances. So back in 1955, there were allegations by his accuser, Carolyn Donham, that he had whistled at her, grabbed her, and asked her for a date, and was talking about things he had done, quote, with white women before. And his accuser said back about 10 years ago in an interview that she wasn't entirely truthful about her recounting of the incident, and that nothing that he did could ever justify what ended up happening to him, which is that Donham's then-husband, Roy Bryant, and her then-husband's half-brother, J.W. Millam, ended up entering a room that Till was sleeping in, abducted him, beat him, threw him in the river using a cotton gin fan to weigh his body down. And so back when he was killed, his mother apparently had asked for an open casket so that folks would understand and appreciate the terrible atrocities that were done to him. And actually, this incident ended up launching the civil rights movement. So interestingly, the Justice Department did not say exactly what the additional new information is in this case that justified reopening the probe. But I guess we'll probably find out in the days and weeks to come.
Yeah, it's interesting how the Department of Justice has recently, and this, you know, this is a trend that we've seen recently with the federal government of looking into these seemingly closed cases after so many years. Again, this is, you know, 63 years after his murder. Obviously, the problem from a legal perspective is obvious, right? People die, witnesses' memories fade, there's statute of limitations issues. In this case, though, as you mentioned, because it is such a symbol of Southern racism, it was really a flashpoint in the civil rights movement. That's why not just this administration, but as far back as Bush, the feds have looked into these charges. All right, moving on to Stormy Daniels, our friend here on Legal Face Off. She was arrested in Columbus this week, and then the charges were immediately dropped the next day. What happened was she's doing a tour of strip clubs around the country. And
is that kind of like a music tour? Is it
like one,
like a Rolling Stones tour,
a little bit? She was arrested by a vice squad, apparently a vice squad of four people, I believe, two of whom were female, and they arrested her for touching and for some other violations of an ordinance there in Columbus. And she was taken away, and then within 24 hours she was released, and the Columbus prosecutor, or I think it was the police, actually said that they made a mistake. They forgot one of the key elements of this charge, which is it is in fact a crime in Columbus to engage in stripping, But the key part that they forgot was that you have to be a regular. This person was not a regular, Stormy Daniels, because she was stripping for the one occasion. So it's okay.
Talk
to
about loopholes.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It's okay to do it once, but she wasn't a regular, so they dropped the charges and, in fact, apologized. Who would have thought that you could arrest a stripper in a strip club?
For doing what one is wont to do in a strip club.
That's true. And Michael Avenatti, her attorney, has now been all over the media saying that this is, you know, this is part of a character smear, and it's part of, you know, the Trump administration going after her. So Stormy Daniels in the news. Moving on to the Indiana Attorney General is in the midst of a scandal. A third woman has come forward today alleging that he, Attorney General Curtis Hill, who is the AG of our neighboring state here, Indiana, is guilty of groping her. This was notable because this was the third woman, but the first Republican to publicly accuse Hill of these allegations. She wrote that at a party in March, he slid his hand down her back and touched her buttocks when she reached to put his hand away. She was a legislative assistant in the Republican caucus in Indiana. And this is, again, the third woman who has come forward alleging these deeds against the attorney general. He has, of course, denied them and has been quite vocal in denying these accusations. You know, I think anytime you have these allegations, it's a serious it's a serious thing. We'll see if he survives it. But, of course, this is part of the Me Too movement that we've covered extensively on the show and, you know, a sign of women feeling more comfortable to come forward. Next story, Tina, is another allegation of sexual inappropriate behavior and, in fact, domestic violence. In addition, LaShawn McCoy, who is a member of the Buffalo Bills, has been accused of domestic violence. A fairly graphic photograph circulated throughout social media this week that showed McCoy's ex, Delicia Corden, bloodied from a robbery that took place at LaShawn McCoy's home in Georgia earlier that day. The image included a message that pointed to LaShawn McCoy as being behind the attack, which is something that her attorney confirmed in a statement to People. She said that her attorney said that she was physically assaulted by a male assailant who entered the home with no signs of forced entry. Since then, though, McCoy has strongly denied these allegations and claimed that he has not been involved. Several of McCoy's teammates have come out and supported him. And I think since then, the breaking news is that maybe she has recanted her story. So there's also other stories this week that we didn't have time to cover involving some other NFL stars. Brandon Browner was charged with attempted murder. So lots going on in the athletic world in terms of legal stories. We move on Legal Face-Off to a lawsuit involving a misappropriated image on a stamp that cost a lot of money.
Yeah, so these are the types of stories that I love. I didn't know that you held them close to your heart too, Rich.
Of course.
So this story involves the post office and its unfortunate improper use of a Statue of Liberty image on its stamp. So what happened here was there was a sculptor who is named Robert Davidson, and he created a replica of the Statue of Liberty for a Las Vegas casino. And somehow the Postal Service that was trying to put together a forever stamp, which depicted the Statue of Liberty, ended up using the wrong photograph of the Statue of Liberty. And what ended up happening was the post office ended up using a picture of the replica rather than a picture of the actual Statue of Liberty.
Whoops.
Yes. And so most people I understand in our listenership would say, you know, big so what, especially when you see a side by side of the real Statue of Liberty and the replica. You can see some differences. Robert Davidson was trying to make the Statue of Liberty replica look a little bit more feminine. But at the end of the day, because what the post office had licensed was the picture of the replica and not the right to actually depict the replica itself on the stamp, under copyright law, you end up in a situation where there can be a lot of damages. The post office tried to argue that there was fair use here, and by saying that it was just a mere copy of a famous statue, and therefore his replica wasn't entitled to copyright protection. But the U.S. Court of Federal Claims disagreed with their argument. And then the big question was what kind of damages Davidson was entitled to. Based on the billions of dollars of stamps sold and the court's focus on the number of stamps that were never used, which they believed was the right analysis for determining damages, Davidson ended up with over $3.5 million in damages.
Wow.
Yeah. So I guess the moral of the story is, and I tell clients this all the time when they ask me questions about copyright and getting licenses to images, for example, through agencies and companies like Getty Images, you need to make sure that you know exactly what the license is for, especially if you're going to have a commercial use of a particular image or other copyrighted work.
And by the way, it looks like just a different person. I mean, on the left, Lady Liberty, the original Lady Liberty, when you look at the picture, she's looking down. I don't think she has pupils in the actual statue.
She looks kind of spooky.
Yeah, the one in Vegas, she's looking up. She's got, you know, you can see her eyeballs and a different nose and, yeah, a lot more feminine.
Yeah,
I might date the one on the right. I might date the Vegas one. I'm not sure I would swipe right for Lady Liberty though. Let's keep moving. Last story, rounding out the legal grab bag here on Legal Face-Off. You know, I've always been fascinated, Tina, by, as you know, rock music. I go to a lot of concerts.
Really, Rich? I didn't know you. I didn't know
you
that.
And David Susser. By the way, I'll be at the
Sustini
Journey concert tomorrow here at
You Radio. Will be. So who's the lead singer?
Of Journey?
Yes.
The small new guy, the Asian guy.
Oh, so the guy, I think he's
Steve
Filipino,
Perry.
Right?
Yeah. Steve Perry's gone.
Well, yeah, with Steve Perry, then Steve O'Jerry. And yeah. Then it's been this guy now, no, I think, like, for about 8 years, right?
Yeah, the guy who was the Journey cover band singer that they found, and now he's the lead singer.
He's good, actually. I've seen them play with him.
But I have always been fascinated with these riders. The legendary rider clause was the Van Halen, no brown M&Ms, right? And, it turns out that a little known fact was they did that because, not because they wanted brown M&Ms removed, but they saw that as a signal as to whether the terms of their rider was being followed. They knew that that was such a small part of minutia that if that wasn't followed, that would be a sign that the bigger issues weren't being followed. But anyway, this is all a lead up to some news about riders in the Taste of Chicago performers' contracts.
Yes.
What do we know?
So what we know is that riders continue to be interesting, the hospitality requests that stars, you know, such as George Clinton and Parliament Funkadelic want when they perform. You know, some of us don't like brown M&Ms. Others of us want, for example, a package of strawberry lemonade flavored Pedialyte. So
who demanded that one?
That was, I think it was Talib Kweli.
Mm-hmm.
So, but yeah,
someone wanted 4 small bottles of Gatorade, no purple.
Yeah. That was Brandi Carlile.
Yeah. It's rivaled only by, Tina Martini's request when she comes to this studio every time. Our listeners should see the list of rider materials.
Oh yeah.
Martini contract, free range chickens.
Hey, that was, that was Clarence. Didn't he like have like whole Clarence chickens Clemens? Or something behind?
Yeah, like four
backstage.
But I pulled out some other famous demands of stars.
Well, I'm sorry, Centrum multivitamins, Clinton, that's George Clinton, not President Clinton.
Yes.
Likes to get a bottle of Centrum multivitamins.
Hmm.
Who would have thought that, you know, multivitamins
well,
would
the
be.
The story was they weren't giving them that, right?
Well, he also wanted a massage therapist.
Yeah. So who do you think is renowned for requiring in her contract bottles of vitamin water to bathe her dogs? Who do you think?
Well, I see Madonna's picture, so.
Not Madonna. It'll be Mariah Carey.
Really?
Madonna demands a brand new lavatory seat for every venue. She also demands lilies and roses that are that have stems trimmed to precisely 6 inches. Marilyn Manson demands gummy bears. My favorite was Britney Spears demands McDonald's cheeseburgers without the buns, 100 figs and prunes, and toothpaste, of course. So,
well, of course, she needs to brush after all that.
I need to get Bob Coyne in here. I need to look at my WGN contract and get more demands, damn it. I need more water to bathe animals and things like that.
I'm going to miss my Argo tea, which I always used to get in the old building.
Yeah, well, we'll get you that. And we also have a big announcement to make. Our co-host here at Legal Faceoff, Tina Martini, has some breaking legal news of her own, yes? Fill us in. Tina, what's going on?
So a week ago today, I joined a new law firm for me.
Lenkov and Associates.
No, it's Martini, Lenkov and Associates. I joined the law firm McDermott, Will & Emery after almost 25 years at DLA Piper. So it has been a great start, and I'm very excited about it. Great group of people. They're terrific lawyers. Actually, Sussler is a client of McDermott.
Wait a second.
Let's back up.
Let's get our heads around this. David Sussler, who is a frequent guest on Legal Faceoff, also co-author of the Inside Out column in Chicago Lawyer Magazine, and third most relevant fact is he is your...
Third most relevant.
...husband. He is your life mate, your husband, your better half. He's now your client.
He's now my client.
Oh, my
God.
That is
They're one of my partners, Dave Rosenblum. So, yes.
You better treat him so much nicer than you ever treated him before.
Yeah, I know. When he wasn't a client back in the DLA days.
I know you're listening. You better leverage this new relationship to the fullest extent possible.
I'm sure he's going to want McDermott swag.
Yes. A hearty congratulations, Tina. Well deserved.
Thank you.
You're going to do even better than you ever have been at this new firm. And we welcome any swag that McDermott wants to shower on us here at Legal Faceoff. For Tina, I am Rich. We got Ben behind the glass and our friend Sam Panianovich, who I'll be seeing in person.
Really?
Right after the next Legal Faceoff, Sam and I will be enjoying Las Vegas together.
I didn't get the invitation.
You're welcome to come.
Okay, thank you.
We'll see you next time on Legal Faceoff on WGN.
It's Christina Martini and Rich Linkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Faceoff. Two lawyers trading jab for jab. So hit them up with any questions you have. WGN Radio, we blowing up your stereo. Got a question, just pick up the phone and they'll let you know.